Hello, and welcome to recording number 16 of Gary Gygax's Artifact of Evil, an annotated reading. Today is August 12th, 2021. We've just heard in the last recording that Melf and company, Chert, Biff, and Lizard, his companions, have tracked down what they think is the band of marauders with the Artifact of Evil. But they've actually tracked down the band of marauders, but Obni and Keek, who Melf just encountered at an inn, unknowingly being the person they're actually seeking. Now, they have gone ahead to Boulderford on the Vang River as it crosses into the area from Furyundi to the Hierarchs of the Horn Society lands. And they've set up an ambush on the Furyundi side of the river, and a big fight's ensued. Melf has cast a poisonous cloud, a cloud kill, and has managed to take part of the column in the cloud. But several of them have survived that, including the Vanguard. Now, Melf is just preparing, after Biff and Lizard were firing missiles, Melf is now preparing to engage with this powerful group at the head of the column. All right, it is page 147, and it's the last paragraph. I'm going to start here. Melf has just cast tentacles that have taken down the horses, at least, and one of the riders in the group at the head of the column. All this occurred in but a trickle of time, a few minutes. Melf scarcely noted the activity, for he had other matters to deal with while the tentacles were seizing his quarry. The Vanguard was nearly in a position to assist their leader, and it was time to deal with this threat. A sheet of flame shot up between outriders and the Huda-bearing horse of the brigand leader, and several of the newcomers were consumed in the leaping tongues of fire, unable to save themselves by swerving or reining up short of the magical conflagration. "Now for the rest," Melf shouted, running so as to place himself in position to cast his next spell. The horsemen milled in a knot before the wall of fire, and suddenly one of their number spotted the running elf. "That's grand," Melf grunted as he came to a sudden halt and began conjuring rapidly with awed, flashing gestures. His voice rose into a keening, whistling chant. Arrows thunked into the ground around him, and one glanced off his metal-shod leg, but ignored them all. "By a stroke of luck, I've ended your resistance," Melf said sardonically, as he watched what occurred next. The horseman had been galloping toward him in a straggle, and his answer had been a terrible bolt of lightning. The electricity was a violet blue, and it struck and leaped, arced and cracked from man to beast, in a sizzling chain of death. When its full course had been run, nothing remained alive. The air was full of the smell of ozone and charred flesh. Despite himself, Melf felt sick. "Why must such be?" he asked the playful breezes softly. Then he returned to his duty. A break. So here, Melf has cast a wall of fire and a chain. I think it's chain lightning that he's cast here. And brought down a large number of the much lesser lesser level and hit point characters that were part of the band. Now, I don't know if he's gotten them all, but he's certainly gotten the ones that were coming toward him. And the immediate ones that were riding up the road to rescue the Vanguard. Now, one of the things this shows, of course, is how effective some of these spells are against masses. And, you know, fireball, wall of fire to an extent, and this chain lightning, or even regular lightning, these are, you know, very, very important spells to have for a battle wizard, or, you know, just if you're planning on using, encountering groups, or if you're, you know, trying to take down something powerful. Now, they're not universally good. Higher level characters can resist. Certain creatures can actually be benefited by fire or lightning. Like a, I believe an iron golem, you actually heal it by sending lightning at it. And we get a little bit of description of the casting of the spell. Not very much, but, and then a little bit of Melf being, you know, a little taken aback by the carnage that he's causing. Whereas, you know, certain characters probably like Chert would toast marshmallows on their burning bodies. So, you know, it does show that Melf is, you know, perhaps a little more civilized. I don't know. All right. I am going to restart. It is page 148 and the third paragraph. I'm sorry, fourth paragraph. Chert was upon the scene, avoiding the tentacles that still writhed, seeking someone or something to grasp. Penwolf the barbarian screamed, the battle cry bringing the two mailed fighters around and on guard against him. The great battle axe Brule buzzed a death song as the massive arms of the giant Hillman brought the blade around in a glittering arc of steel. The war axe cleaved mesh and steel plate. Gurgling, one of the foemen pitched forward, a mortal wound gaping where the axe had nearly cut him in twain at the waist. His comrade, however, was upon Chert with a howl, delivering a stroke with his broadsword that left a red furrow across the barbarian's right arm. The two opponents settled down to a duel, axe versus broadsword, to the death. "Shaz sneers at me," Melf exclaimed, watching a wounded horse begin to trot slowly down the track. Before engaging Chert, the two henchmen of the mysterious rider had managed to chop the constricting tentacles. The magical members had inflicted bloody damage upon the helpless warhorse, but the animal still stood and carried its hooda and rider away as commanded. The horse was slow, and Melf acted quickly. He again gestured, uttered a strange staccato string of syllables, and shot forth his arm. With forefinger extended, a series of thick greenish bolts shot forth. Each glowing missile followed its predecessor unerringly to impact upon the canopied arrangement atop the huge destrier. Break. All right, so there's Melf casting his acid arrows. But we also, we see Chert here crying out Penwolf. I don't believe he's uttered that battle cry before. I'm a little surprised he wasn't calling for Brule, his, you know, axe that normally it needs to be, you need to call out its name, I believe, to activate some of its special abilities. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it is activated by name. And I don't remember Penwolf either.
Yeah, so I think that's new. But it definitely, it's just a battle cry. I'm not sure what it means. I wonder if Gygax may enlighten us further down in the story. All right, so we see... now, I know that it's the gnome leader, and previously Melf had made a comment that he uses illusion, so I wonder if we're going to be surprised with the rest of the battle right here. And yes, I think that is going to be true. I'm going to restart. It's page 100.
Oh, another thing. He yelled out, Shaz.
Shaz sneers.
Ralishaz?
You know, luck for Ralishaz.
Okay, it is Ralishaz.
Yeah, and so Shaz is going to be Melf's, you know, Melf's quick, you know, abbreviation of Ralashaz's name. And I think one of the things that, that this points out, and it's something that I saw in Saga of Old City, is that I think that the various deities, Iridian, Sul, Flan, I think they're used in a mishmash sort of way. Unless there are really like true followers, I think that like if we look at what Gord had been saying back in Saga of Old City, it seemed several different people, you know, use different deities where they'd bring up their name, and it seemed to be very commonplace and not so much as like a worshipful summons or prayer, but just a lot of times as a kind of you know, exclamation that it's being used as, especially Ralashaz tends to be used that way, I think, like, you know, in gambling and such, that your luck, about your luck there. So I think that this really says something about how Gygax saw the various deities being used in the setting, that maybe there were certain followers of certain deities who were very devout. But I think in general that the pantheon of, well, not even the pantheon, because we have three different cultures, and four if we conclude the Backlunish, then I think that these names are just, a lot of them, they're respectful in a sense. The deities are real, so they don't want to be disrespectful. But I think they're using these in a much more commonplace way than a lot of people think of the various deities. I just think that they're very well known, certain ones, and I think that they're used, you know, that they're used much more commonplace. Now, Chris has put up the little blurb from Greyhawk Adventures about Ralashaz, who's a lesser deity, neutral but neutral evil, a chaotic neutral evil. Ralashaz the unlooked for, randomness and madness, that he brings unforeseen events which bring woe more often than wheels. So he unfortunately, if something happens that you know, kind of like your horse shows a throws a shoe, and then gets lame, and that could be, you could call that as, you know, one of the things that Ralashaz is responsible for. He is supposed to have few worshippers, but a handful of small shrines in modest temples in large cities and out of the way places. His services compose random notes played on various musical instruments, babbling, castings of various augury devices. Now this is Greyhawk Adventures, so I you know, you kind of take a lot of things coming out from Greyhawk Adventures with a, you know, cup of salt here, just to you don't necessarily, it's not necessarily going to be the way that the Gygax saw the deity, or later Sargent or something, because Greyhawk Adventures came out in this period between the updates of the campaign. It was post Gygax, but pre Sargent. So, and Sargent really took to rewriting a lot of stuff and taking into account a lot of things that happened with the Greyhawk Wars box set. All right.
I couldn't find any other mention of Penwolf either. It's just listed as a phrase in Artifact of Evil and later once again in Knight Errant.
Ah, yes, and it's probably in Knight Errant's probably Chert once again calling out, but maybe we do get a little more information, but probably not. There's a lot of little mysterious tidbits throughout these books.
That itself is interesting.
Yeah, I know. It's one of the things I love. All right, I'm going to restart. It is page 149, paragraph 2. This is not so, and I do not believe, Melf said loudly, as he observed the effect of the spell. When the last of the greenish streaks struck the Huda-like affair, the draperies burst into a sudden fire. A flash followed, and then horse and Huda were no more. Only a greasy brownish cloud of smoke wafted slowly down the path where mount and rider had been. "Bring me true vision," the elven mage uttered as he passed the symbol of Farlangen before his eyes. Revealed thus was the same destrier in its odd trappings, proceeding as if nothing had occurred, save for the scorched areas of the canopy where his magic missiles had struck home. Break. Now, I had assumed that that greenish, the bolts were acid arrows, but it appears they're magic missiles. And that does bring up a thing about illusions. Magic missiles usually hit unerringly, so if you're aiming at the illusion, I guess they would unerringly hit the illusion. And if you disbelieve, then they unerringly hit the creature you were, or person you were aiming at. Now here then, he then is, with the symbol of Farlangen, he's using it to cast the spell of, I guess, true vision, or else the symbol may have that magical ability within it. Now, Melf is a fighter wizard, so it would not be a clerical spell, or a magical item that only a cleric could use. Farlangen actually does get, you know, if we remember our Saga of Old City, we do get exposure to Farlangen far more than I think other deities so far. Although in this book, they've been encountering Celestian. All right, I am going to restart. It's page 149. And paragraph 3. "Now it's time for the final act of this charade," Melf said, as he took flight, arrowing directly toward the concealed figure atop the horse. Before him extended a spear that grew magically as he flew, changing from a weapon the height of a tall man to an ashen shaft as long as a horseman's lance. "Behind you, you bastard," Melf shrieked just before he was upon his target. He saw the wizened visage of a gnome, one eye nearly popping, the other squinted, nearly closed. The demi-human was frantically gesturing in order to evoke some Diomer, but only a vague fountain of muddled colors sprang forth before Melf's broad-bladed spear took the creature in the shoulder. The impact nearly sent Melf spinning, but he managed to continue. The gnome was carried from the Huda, trailing a ragged tail of draperies. "Quarter," he screamed, dangling like a speared fish. Melf ceased his magical flight, using the impaling spear to pin the foe to the ground as his feet jolted upon the turf. One look told him that the illusion-using gnome was an extremis and would die soon indeed. "Your death can be quick and clean, or I can keep you suffering for some time yet. That is the only quarter you will receive from me. Now, your choice." The gnome peered desperately around. Then he glared hatefully at his slayer. "My curse forever upon your foul, peaked-eared head elf, for what you have done to me," he screamed defiantly. Melf leaned upon the magic spear and twisted the shaft. The malign visage before him crumpled in pain, and the gnome's knotty arms and legs thrashed wildly. "Mercy, mercy," screamed the small creature. "The curse is withdrawn." "Demons and devils take your miserable little curse, you stinking creature of woe," spat Melf. "I care not a jot about such mouthings. What is your name? Where is the dwarf who is your leader? Tell me that, and then you may have mercy." "Gleed. I am called Gleed, and my leader is not here." Melf twisted the weapon again and raised his voice to be heard over the gnome's cries of pain. "What is the name of this fellow, and what have you, or he, done with the object you have stolen from the far Sus Forest?" Ah, stop. I serve Obmi. Obmi the dwarf. He is to be here, awaiting us now. And the ancient item I know you have, Melf demanded, still leaning heavily on his spear. It is with Obmi. He and Keek were to distract pursuit, while the rest of us crossed Furiundi and made for the haven of the Hierarch's lands. Damn and curse you. Pale-faced, Melf slowly eased his pressure and stared unbelievingly at the gnome. Could this Gleed be telling the truth? You say Obmi, a dwarf, has the item, and that this one is abetted by someone named Keek. Tell me now, and do not try my patience further. Is this Keek a tall and thin elf who is given to hysterical laughter? Yes, yes, no more, elf. Give what you have promised. Melf spoke a word softly under his breath, and the ashen spear changed suddenly into a javelin of but 3 cubits in length, its head a long triangle of steel rather than a leaf-tip point. With a sudden shuddering sigh, the gnome was released of pain, for the small weapon was no longer impaling him. Before anything else could transpire, however, the sunlight on the meadow suddenly dimmed, as if a cloud had passed overhead. Abney, the wounded gnome, called as loudly as he could. Raucous cawing and piercing croakings answered his plea. A battering wing struck Melf's shoulder, and a sharp beak as large as a small knife drove at his eyes. There ensued a whirlwind battle, a melee of elf versus a storm of swooping, croaking ravens the size of eagles. Using javelin and sword, Melf managed to slay a dozen of the vile birds in half as many minutes, but he was bleeding from as many wounds as well. Worse, there seemed to be more of the creatures winging down to join the fray, so that each time one squawked and fell dead, 2 were there to take the place of their dead flockmate. Then there were cries of anger and rage from the mass of foul ravens, and they flapped upward for a moment, giving Melf a respite. Wiping blood from his face, he glanced around to find the cause of the raven's retreat. They like not Brule, a grinning church said, slowly swinging the long axe with mighty arms as gore-stained as the weapon's broad blade. Wounded ravens flopped on the ground at his feet. Several decapitated bodies were spread around him in a welter of inky feathers and crimson splatters. Well done, cried Melf. Perhaps now I can work up a bit of magic to finish them all. Here they come again, said the barbarian, bringing Brule up and inscribing a steely loop overhead to greet the swooping attack of the huge ravens. A pair of the birds plummeted downward like stones. One had a thick quarrel protruding from its open beak, the other no head at all, for a lead missile had carried the whole away when it found its marks. Unaware of the slaughter so done, the flock again attacked, giving no time for casting of spells. It was a brief sortie, though. Every bird that flapped up was brought low by bolt or sling bullet. Those within reach fell to axe, sword, and needle-pointed javelin. The carrion eaters flee, Melf said triumphantly as he sent a burning swarm of magical shafts after the birds. The glowing streaks hit a handful of the ravens and sent them tumbling and falling, dead, to the leaves, sooty bundles of filth on the fair green of the sward. What's left of them, Chert agreed laconically, for even as Melf laid several low, a pair fell from quarrel and sling. Only a dozen or so of the ravens lived to voice their mournful cause of hatred from a distance growing ever greater as they winged northward, back from where they had come. Well done, I say again, said the elven spellcaster, this time not only to Chert, but to his halfling friend and the lean crossbowman who accompanied him. No great matter, Lizard said as he and Biff strolled toward the panting pair of combatants. Strolled was perhaps not the correct description, for the arbalest limped, and Biff walked slowly, favoring his wounded left side. "Aye, that's so," the halfling concurred as he halted near Melfinchurt. "This mountain and you, master, would have knocked all those stinking wormbags from the air. Without us, our shooting merely hastened the process." Chert patted the halfling gently atop his thick-haired head. "Thanks nonetheless, Minimus. The mountain appreciates the assistance of the mole." "Contest elsewhere was hot," offered Lizard, "but the cowards at the rear eventually broke and ran, taking their prisoners with them as shields. We saw the circling ravens, so we gave up pursuit and came here instead." "How many escaped?" Melf asked. "No more than 7 or 8 all told. Lizard and I had a small contest, but neither he nor I won," Biff said with a crooked smile. "Wrong, halfling. Who slew more blackbirds?" Lizard stared unwinkingly at the still-grinning Biff as he spoke. "You did keep count even then, did you? Indeed, as you have." "Just so," Biff laughed, "and you gain my tithe." Chur interrupted the banter. "There," the barbarian hillman cried, pointing as he shouted. "What is that?" Melf spat as he saw the cause for Chert's surprise. A bowshot distance away, a gray-black horse had appeared suddenly from a clump of scrub. The odd-looking animal was running with impossible speed toward the river. "No matter," the elf said heavily. "It is but the vile little gnome using a phantom steed to escape us. A pity, for he is evil and undeserving of life. But that is of small consequence to us." "The treasure, what of the artifact he bore?" Bill asked. "I was duped and led us on the trail of those whom that crafty dwarf wished us to follow. Although I never saw this Omni, I allowed him to slip through my fingers, and the artifact with them." "How so?" asked the brawny hillman as he cleaned his great axe. "At the inn days ago, Omni is accompanied by a lieutenant. This miserable mad elf is called Keek. I met and had converse with him there. The crafty jackal set me on this path while he and his evil master made for safety elsewhere," Melf said with a shake of his head. Lizard laughed mirthlessly. "Laying low this pack of dogs is righteous work regardless. And now it is time to move on, I think." Break. All right. Chris has posted color spray, and I thought, too, that might have been what Gleed had been casting. It may have been something else, but it really did sound like color spray to me. Now, that was quite a bit of reading right there without breaks, because, it's mostly action. We see a little bit of, the characters. Lizard seems to be, he talks about righteousness and stuff. He seems to have some kind of religious belief or some kind of pathos that he is following. Some kind of philosophy that he follows. Biff, again, is, the entertaining, smart alecky halfling. Chert is Chert, there we have a little bit with Melf. But in general, again, it shows, like with Gleed, who is willing to sell out, not even for life, but for a less painful death. Although, what I find interesting is that he is gravely wounded, and yet he's still able to cast spells, and he's still able to escape. So we have to understand that the book does not say the actual truth of the situation. It says what Melf considered to be true. Or, so they're all what we call unreliable narrators. So while Melf considered Gleed on death's door, that's just what Melf was thinking. And I that is something that needs to be kept in mind when reading this story all the way through, is that what we hear is coming from a point of view and is not necessarily going to be the absolute truth. There really is very little objective narration in this, where we just hear that something is such and that is how it is. Instead, we hear quite a bit from different points of view. Now, we get a little more about several spells that were cast, and Melf is a pretty high-level magic user, even in first edition AD&D, and at this point, he has quite an array, and that magic item. I think his spear must be described in one of his, because it's one of his write-ups, because it is such a powerful little weapon there. And also his ability to cast himself into flight. I don't remember exactly why Melf can do that, but he can, and then he has the magic spear, which is a very handy combination. Now, we hear it goes from lance to spear to javelin, and I don't know quite how much smaller it goes. In a sense, it kind of reminds me of, several powerful magical items like the Rod of Seven Parts or the, I believe it's the Axe of Lordly Might. I'm not maybe offhand, but all of those can transform into various kinds of weapons. All right. And now we have that those poor prisoners have escaped. But this is, again, quite a situation here where we notice Melf has no hesitation using torture. So definitely not not a strong follower of certain, good deities or anything like a paladin. He is a elven fighter magic user. And, I think that he's just going to use whatever is going to be handy for the situation. And so those prisoners, who are mostly women, taken to be sold as slaves, they're probably off to their own fate unless Gygax. Now, only 7 or 8 survivors out of this large band, and no telling who they were, humans, dwarves, elves, gnomes. It's very hard to say, but they've managed to slay quite a few of the lesser and all of the, outside of Gleed, all of the higher level and stronger characters and fighters and such are now dead.
I didn't see anything regarding the ravens.
Well, the ravens had been part of the Hierarchs group. They had been summoned. When they get to Boulderford, they spot the Hierarchs across the river, and Melf goes in invisible. He can also turn invisible, fly, and he goes, takes his invisible scouting flight out there. And then he notices that the Hierarchs have summoned up a large flock or murder of ravens. And he's worried that even invisible, they'll be able to detect him. So he goes off, and the ravens are still flying around in the air. What surprises me is that they came to the aid of Gleed. But then again, they may be able to recognize in the armored elf as somebody who they would naturally oppose. It really depends on what kind of orders they were given or what kind of senses that they have. But it is interesting to me that Gleed is able to come and summon their aid. And also that I'm not surprised they were sent up to scout. So I'm not surprised that this very visible fight with fireballs, walls of fire, lightning bolts, that they do not, that the ravens do come to see what's going on. But again, a little surprised that they do answer and help Gleed. Now,
There must be some reason that force is amassed by the Hierarchs, with actually even one of the Hierarchs present. Is it possible that Omni alerted them?
I mean, I would say it's possible. I mean, Omni or... because remember, while Uz told him, that he needed to, escape, he did not necessarily aid him in any way. So it is possible, I think, that, or strangely, remember, Uz isn't at war with the Hierarchs at this point. He's pretending to have accepted the loss of Molag and the eastern area of his territory till biding his time. And so he could have alerted them. And remember, but I don't think Obmi had mentioned to us, but we don't really know what happened after that. Right. But at the point where Obmi and us were in contact, he didn't mention Boulder Ford. Although it is a likely crossing place. Now, later on in Anna Meyer's map, because this is what's listed later, there's actually a fortification at Boulder Ford on the Uz side of the river. Because remember, the Hierarchs are destroyed in the Greyhawk War, so now Uz retakes that whole area. But it would have seemed likely that it's such a broad, easy ford of the Vang that they would have been able to... cross, they would have had patrols or some kind of watch on that very open ford of the Vang River. Now, here Chris has posted about Zagig's spear, Melfin Zagig's spear.
From what I got out of it, Melf found that in the Castle Greyhawk.
Yeah, and so that is Zagig's spear, a very... very handy thing. And of course, Melf did some solo exploration of the castle. So yeah, you know, when he was very powerful. and there at the end, Gygax took the spear away when he decided it was too powerful. And so that is very amusing, because it is quite a almost like an artifact level magic weapon right there.
Yeah, I mean, that's easy enough for DM to do. Anytime he has a crit, he can just make him roll. Sooner or later, he's going to fail a save.
Yeah. So here, that is very interesting. That's a great little tidbit there. I am going to restart. It is page 153 and paragraph 5. His three companions followed the direction of his steady gaze. They saw a thick black fog forming on the other shore of the river. Above the gloom flew a score of the nighted ravens. "This bodes ill indeed," said Melf. "Do what you wish here, but be ready to ride southward soon. I go to see what foulness is being invoked across the Vang. My guess is that it won't stay there long." Melf was back before half an hour had passed. "Black fog is the very essence of Hades itself," he told the others. "It oozes across the river slowly, but once on this bank it will come as a juggernaut. Get the horses. We ride now." The four rode rapidly through the thickening twilight. High above, to the north, black specks circled. Keen-eyed ravens watched the progress of the adventurers and conveyed their route to those hidden by the enveloping shroud of vapors. Elf's group rode on after nightfall, leaving the rutted path and angling cross-country to the west. The pace was easy, for a horse could easily break a leg if ridden hard in such conditions. Every hour they would stop to change horses, walking for a bit, and washing down dry rations with tepid water as they went. All right, so, here is this thing summed up probably by the Hierarch, some kind of cloud, you know, as Melf is saying something from the very essence of Hades. So here we can't tell what it is. Melf is just, I does not sound like he's mentioning that from knowledge. It seems more like it is more that he knows the Hierarchs, and that this cloud is something that appears to him as if it's, you know, something hellish. Now, I like this little bit where they talk about, changing the horses and being easy, taking an easy ride at night. Now, Gygax had previously been in Saga of the Old City, a little bit seemingly unknowledgeable about horses. And I don't know. Now, he's made sure that all these riders have a change of mounts. And now, under nightfall conditions, they're taking it very easy. And all things I think you really need to consider as a DM when your characters are doing it is not to stop them. But if they do something like this and they override their horses, then you do have them injured. You can roll for it and you can have them. They can be injured. They can be killed. They can throw the players. It is not, the horses are not like some magical device. In fact, if horses are fairly, big horses especially, are fairly delicate, and you can ride them to death. So, you know, it is something to consider and something that will eventually teach the players what they can and cannot do within the game world. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page 153 and second paragraph from the end. "Let's call a halt here," Melf called softly. "The copse of trees yonder should be suitable for our needs." Biff, being the least wounded of the party, volunteered to stand watch while the other three slept. Melf had no more than closed his eyes, it seemed, when the halfling's urgent warning brought him to full awareness. "Melf, come quickly, this way. Something terrible comes this way now. I feel an awful terror in my very bones." "Get the others up and armed," Melf replied to the frightened halfling, "while I go to see what the nature of the beast is." As Melf moved away from the camp, he could hear the quiet sounds of veterans readying for some unknown peril. There were no calls or cursings, only the matter-of-fact noise of armor being donned and weapons unsheathed. Chur and Lizard had been awakened, and with Biff were making ready for who knew what. Melf crept to the verge of the grove, staying well within the shadows, peering in the direction they had come. He too sensed a great malign presence here. Peering skyward, the elven mage noted that the very starry expanse was blackened and blurred. Then he heard a creaking beat, accompanied by groans and a soughing of the air. His knees shook, and it took all of his will to stand and face what came. Terror washed over him in waves, and something deep inside his mind tried to compel him to scream and fall down in despair. Instead, Melf drew forth a slender wand of adamantite. The ancient metal was engraved with curious squiggles, and the tip bore a pale, milky crystal. He stroked the device and whispered, bringing the crystalline point into luminescence. "Now let us see what you are," he drawled casually, denying his fear. He inscribed a glowing rectangle in the air before him, and as he completed it, the phosphorus from the tip of the wand flowed to form a plane of palest violet before him. This effect was duplicated instantly in the air before the oncoming thing, as it flapped and groaned and sent terror in driving waves before it. An ear-splitting roar shook the trees as the thing struck the magical force thrown up before it by the elven demon crafter. Melf looked away from the abomination that the interplay of force and malign magic of the lower regions created when they met. The vaguely bat-like demon was elephantine in size and terrible of visage. It struggled against the screen of energy, tearing madly with mindless fury. As the monstrosity broke through, Melf worked quickly, causing another and yet a third plane of force to spring into magical being. "May you tear yourself to bits fighting such," he said vehemently to the unhearing monster. Then he turned and ran to where his companions waited. This was a thing to flee from, not to fight. The group broke from the trees in a rush. Reckless now of rough ground, The mounts galloped without urging, spurred on by the malign waves of fear inspired by the flying daemon from the deepest pits of Hades itself. It seemed as if they would actually escape, for the abomination was still battling the last of Melf's force walls when they rode away. Soon enough, however, the soughing was all around them again, and with it the stench of vilest evil. "Now we must dismount and make it pay dearly for our souls," Melf said heavily. Even as they prepared, the heavens were shaken by a triumphant bellow, and the beating of monstrous pinions resounded from the hills. The four stood in line facing the onrushing monster conjured from the depths of woe. Each knew this would be his last battle. Break. This is the end of chapter... Of chapter 13. How appropriate. We get again... this is actually a daemon summoned up by the Hierarchs. And the daemons do seem to be a kind of like... almost like a mercenary kind of force. In that... the demons are definitely with us, and the devils are definitely with the Horn Society, and I believe the Scarlet Brotherhood as well. But the demons I see being used, now here they're being used by devil worshippers, so unless Gygax has the Hierarchs being demon worshippers, I'm not sure what changes there are within this setting. Melf is producing, it's interesting, there's a nice little description of a wand of Wall of Force, and the daemon is so powerful that he's able to dispel or break three walls of force, as he's pursuing them, so they don't get very far. And it is clearly a very, very powerful creature. Now, you'll notice, one of the things is that they're all wounded. They didn't get that priest of Celestian to accompany them, or send a healer along. And this is one of the things about, you know, the edition we're talking about. This is definitely first edition. Because later on, you know, it was felt that they wanted more, quicker healings and kind of... quicker adventures. So there was a lot of these healing surges and self-healings that I believe anyone could cast. I am a little surprised that at such a powerful group that they don't have some kind of healing potions or healing spells such as scrolls or even the salve, the healing salve that I believe Curly used earlier. That they wouldn't be in possession of some kind of healing things. They don't know how badly hurt they are. One of the things, though, is that there is mention how they get to the cops and Biff wakes up Melf, and it doesn't seem like Melf has had any chance to relearn his spells. So a lot of these spells that he perhaps could have been effective against the demon, like Lightning Bolt, or Fireball, or Wall of Fire, may have been effective or not, but they don't seem like they would be available to Melf at this point. Now, he has used some magic, but at his level, he should have some things left, but I believe he's used at least 7 or 8 spells in that previous encounter. He's done Cloud Kill, he's done Lightning, Wall of Fire, he's done Magic Missile. So he's, you know, he's done several spells already, and I don't believe, unless he's using them from some kind of enchanted thing like the Wand of Wall of Force, then I don't know how much he has left. He does have Zagig's spear, though, and this may be one of the reasons that Gary Gygax later felt it was too powerful, because with that spear, maybe he does have a chance of killing the highly powerful daemon that's been summoned against them. Right. I'm going to restart. It is chapter 14, page 157. One. Parsifal's plan is a sound one, Deirdre concluded. I say we divide our party as he suggests. It is stupid, Gord retorted angrily. The brigands are riding northward across the frontier region, and you would divert our strength to turn southward. More debate followed, while the elven constable sat back with hauteur fixed upon his countenance. The party had traveled to the Kron Hills, riding the hippogriffs of Selene's elite chivalry. Parsival and a score of noble guards had accompanied them. Now another matter had arisen. Upon alighting near the village of Hamlet, a small settlement set around a crossroads, they had been met by the local lord, Bernie, titled Worshipful Magus by the Viscount of Verbabog, and his lieutenant, Sir Rufus of Skipperton. These stalwarts had given the party intelligence on recent events. The band of hard-bitten riders had called themselves Free Traders. Their leader was a dwarf with a squint-eyed gnome and a stick-like elf in company. The strength of the brigand assemblage was no more than 36 of mixed human and demi-human races. And with this band were a string of pack horses and a few small two-wheeled wains. This information was almost an aside, however. All right, break. So we get an idea about their number. According to when Uz killed the one bandit, there were about 20 of the brigands left. So the rest of the group sounds like it's about 12 at this point. And I'd actually thought there would be a larger group. Now, that would, you know, that brings things down pretty much. There's 4 strong fighters and Gleed that we know of. And then there are a bunch of lesser strength fighters. So the band of elves, gnomes, and dwarves must have been a very small little group of them indeed. If the total number is only about 36 or 36 to 40, or I'd say. We we get the description. So the general wagon train here of two-wheeled wains and the string of pack horses, which are again described by Melf, and when they encounter Melf. All right. It's nice to get a little touch of Hamlet here. We get a mention of Bernie and Rufus. Both of them, Bernie getting his title from the Viscount, and I don't know if Sir Rufus is, or offhand where Skipperton is. It may just be a one name mentioned there. All right. I am going to restart. It is page 157 and the final paragraph. They left the village next morning. Sir Rufus told the group. They left without disturbance, paying for all they had used, food, lodging, supplies. I had them followed by a pair of scouts, but these ill-looking traders merely went off down the road to Verbabank, not doing anything other than travel their way. My men turned back in the afternoon, with the train still heading northward. You allowed them to simply ride away, Deirdre said derisively. Bernie shrugged. Word of their depredations only reached us yesterday. Besides, I doubt what strength we can muster here would have been sufficient. Quite right, Geller said firmly. Your duty is to protect this community and to report activities of interest. You have done well by any measure. The folk of the Welkwood expect us to aid them, Sir Rufus interjected. But it will take 2 days to raise the levy and several more to reach the rallying point. Had we attempted to interfere with passers-by, who made no trouble, where would we be now in this time of need? He concluded, giving the girl a challenging stare. Deirdre reacted hotly, her hand upon her sword hilt. Celebrated as heroes rather than ones who make cautious excuses, she shot back. Dead heroes are unreceptive to celebrations, Curly Greenleaf said dryly. Turning to Parsival and his fellows, the druid inquired, But you, Lord Constable, might make this your cause. The woodsmen of the Welkwood are no affair of Selene, said Parsival. Bernie smiled softly and raised a finger. But it was the elves of that wood who asked our help, he countered. What's this? Demanded Lord Parsifal. As my friend related earlier, Lord Constable, there is a great horde of humanoids and men raging through the Whelkwood. They gather up the evil hiding within the forest, gaining strength as they come. Their path has been traced from the Sus Forest far south of here, and it seems they intend to traverse the entire woodlands all the way to the Gnarly. These are the very ones who followed us from the start, Oscar observed. If so, Deirdre added, we must join with those who oppose them, for such is our duty. The debate that followed divided the party. Geller pointed out that the enemy was escaping northward, and that the ravaging horde within the forest was merely a diversion. The Cavalier would have none of it, for she saw things in another light. In her estimation, this horde had threatened them. Blanc, undoubtedly one of its minions, had slain Jacote and the three apprentices of Greenleaf without mercy. Possibly they were moving to reinforce the dwarf-led brigands as well, suggested Deirdre. For none knew for certain that the caravan had not veered eastward, to take shelter within the fastness of the Gnarly Forest until their fellow murderers arrived to assist them. The female cavalier insisted that duty required her to ride to the aid of those who opposed this evil horde, and that those who refused to accompany her had neither honor nor courage. At this point, the elven constable proposed that he make ready to accompany any force that was bent on bringing the ravagers to battle. For subjects of Selene were involved, after all. He and his squadron of hippogriff-mounted warriors would be certain to locate the enemy and bring them to bay. There were mounts, after all, for the party as well, and Deirdre's words were befitting a chivalrous noble of Selene as well as a patriot of Hardby. Gord is correct, if tactless, Geller said. Our mission is to recover an instrument of most malign power from the clutches of evil. I too would say we must stop the humanid despoilers from their savagery, were we not otherwise sworn. The greater evil and the greatest good lie northward. There we must go. Oscar and I go to slay these foul raiders, Deirdre said with finality. You others can do as you wish. The one-eyed bard was grim-faced as he nodded. And so be it. Let us see who will remain faithful, he said. Deirdre seemed to wince at these words, and Oscar turned away but made no objection to the cavalier's assertion that he would accompany Parsifal and the rest against the horde to the south. Break. All right, so we have quite a bit in going on with the storyline. Now, but if we look at some of the lore, we get a little bit here about Hamlet. Now, it is well known that this is what Bernie and Rufus would do, but I'm not quite sure if we know. We probably knew that the directive is for Rufus to protect this area and to keep an eye on the happenings around the area. Now, they've just built that tower, but they're going to quite a big deal of construction. And I would assume, although Hamlet is around this fortification that's being built in Hamlet, it is actually more an aid of the whole area. And I doubt that Hamlet, as a little farming village, unwalled, would actually exist in this area by itself. Verbabank probably consists of quite a few of the of similar, bigger or smaller little thorps and hamlets. Now, Chris is posted about Bern and Rufus here. Bern is only AC8. He's only got 30 hit points, and I believe he's an 8th level magic user, which is fairly powerful. Rufus is a 6th level fighter. They're a good little pair here, especially for a small area like Hamlet. They could be almost adventurers for the adventuring thing for delving into the Temple of Elemental Evil. But that, again, they're probably watching for the rise of things from the temple. I think everyone's wise enough to know that even though the temple was destroyed, it has some kind of effect that draws evil to it. So we have more about the characters, and it is good to see that you do have these things with parties as a DM where they want to split up, where they have different interests, and it is always a very hard thing to deal with as a DM when your party decides to split. I've really enjoyed this little bit here, but it was heavily on the action, and I think we've summed up most of the lore we can get. We get a little more about Celine, the constable's isolationism, but again, that the elves of the Whelkwood are citizens of Celine. So, that's good night. Good night, Chris. And, I'm going to call Craig and kick him out. Just waiting to see if there's any commentary here you'd like to make. Okay, and that's it for tonight. That was recording number 16.